session number 4617, room number 8.
Armand, relate.
Well, after they rebuilt these fuel tanks, the oil tanks, we were very grateful, and we took them back and refitted them, and the rest of the trip home back to base was quite uneventful. I'd love to. I think we took those tanks out and sent them up to Unaidi as an example of what could be done, and we fitted standard oil tanks in the plane. Well, when we got back there, my boat was in such a state that we decided to do a complete rebuild of it, and so it was stripped down, and I never flew again with that squadron then. That was the end of my... It took 3 months to do this rebuilding. Well, one other thing that's rather interesting too was we had a new station commander, a group captain Calloway, and went on one of his trips down, which had been in just before we'd gone to second trip to Singapore. He'd gone on a cruise to the Persian Gulf and had landed at Ras Al Khaimah. Now, this was a sort of landlocked bay there, and in a curve, and when one landed or took off, it wasn't a straight run, you had to curve. He didn't like this at all, and he thought that he would like to try to take off across instead of the lengthwise of it. He thought he would try to take off across, and he'd set the boat to go across and instead of, when he opened up the engines, he said he had an engine failure, and that's the official record. Unofficially, instead of moving 4 throttles forward, he'd only moved 3, so he only had 3 engines, and so the boat didn't lift off the water, and it ploughed ashore and ploughed ashore for half a mile across the sand, and it says a lot for the strength of these flying boats that it was practically undamaged. And after they'd switched off and sort of recovered themselves and got out and thought, what the deuce are we going to do now, there was a usual nomad appeared. It didn't matter where you went there, there was always an odd bod would come from somewhere. It's like, I suppose it's the same in this country, at home here. But out there in all those miles and miles of desert, there was always somewhere an odd man would appear. And this odd chappy appeared, and he went away, and then shortly afterwards, a motor car, and this was a local sheikh, who'd come in his little motor car, and he came across and sort of wanted to know what was going on and could he help. And so they said, well, the only thing to do, we want to get this back there to the sea again. What did he do? He got all his men and he dug a canal right this half mile back to the sea, and they floated this boat back to the sea again, and it was virtually undamaged, really. One of the struts on the one of the floats was a bit bent, and one of the wires was broken, but I think that was all.
So he didn't expect payment?
Well, he would be paid something or other, but not a great deal. But the ship, they dug this canal right back. Group Captain Calloway never went back there again. But, and maybe there to this day, I don't know, but it wasn't long afterwards, a big board appeared and was firmly fixed in the ground. It was marked Calloway's Canal. Anyway, that was that sort of, I think that's about all of the flying boats. We never carried a parachute. I never had a parachute in the whole of my 7 years nearly on flying boats.
Why
never
not?
You flew over sea. So if you came down, you had a parachute entangled around you in the sea, I suppose. But never did we carry a parachute. And never felt the need of one either.
So where did you go to after Basra?
Well, after Basra, I thought I'd, by signing on, that I would perhaps come back to England. But in fact, I did a total of 3.5 years. I went there in 1934, and I left there in 1938. And it would be in March 1938 when the next posting list came up of the people to be repatriated. And I came to look for my name to go back to UK, but it wasn't there. I had to go to India. So I was sent to India, and we went down in a Navassa, down to Karachi, and then I found I was going to Kohat. It was a day and a night on the train to Rawalpindi, and then another train for Rawalpindi to Kohat, and I joined number 60 squadron, and they had Wapiti aircraft. Now these aircraft, I was a junior boy again, so once again after nearly 4 years abroad I'd lost my flying pay and my 10 and 6 pence a week again, and back on my basic pay again. There was no promotion in India. That's that famous song, "You get no promotion this side of the ocean." They worked on establishment. The Indian government paid the British government for the services of the troops there, and there was an establishment for so many airmen, so many NCOs, so many officers and such on. So there was very rarely any promotion there. And I found that when I went to Kohat, that once again I was a junior boy and was relegated to workshops and repairing fabric wing covers and so on. I was rather disappointed because I thought I was an experienced air gunner and by that time and quite a senior leading air craftsman, but however, it wasn't to be. But I enjoyed my time there. During the summer months in India, everyone used to go to the hills for 2 months, and to Murray, but that was the nearest centre, Upper Topa it was called. And there were two Topas. There was Upper Topa where the single men were, and the Lower Topa where the married families were. All the families were sent up to the hills during the summer months, and the husbands went up for just the 2 months as the single men did. And we had 1 month of service training, and the other second month was holiday. On my way up there, I was lucky enough to go up in my first year there, and I was unlucky enough on my way up. I was felt ill. We went by train to Rawalpindi, and then from Rawalpindi by lorry. It was always 3-ton lorry with benches in the back to sit on, and then you went from Rawalpindi up to Topa in these lorries, and I felt dreadful. And by the time I got to Topa, I had a high temperature. I could feel I had a temperature, and I didn't feel very well at all. So I went straight into sick quarters, and a couple of days there, but they couldn't get my temperature down, so they sent me to the British Medical Office, BMH, the British Military Hospital at Murray, where they treated me for malaria. Well, after a week they decided it wasn't malaria that I had, but it was acute gastritis. So I was transferred to the medical ward. And after a further week in the medical ward, being treated for acute gastritis. They changed their minds once again and said that it was sandfly fever. But by the time I was feeling a bit better, and I started complaining about the food, and it was a military hospital, and they looked on things a little differently to the RAF, and when I complained of the food, they just arbitrarily dismissed me and said, right, out, my boy. And so I was dismissed and back to the sick quarters at the RAF sick quarters at Topa, to the kind administrations of the RAF hospital doctor. And after a few days in there, I recuperated sufficient to leave. But of course, that was my first month there, and I'd missed the service training. But the second month was coming up, and incidentally, I'd gone to this station at Kohat, and my previous two crew members were there. So we were able to make a threesome again. And they came to see me, and we all decided we would go to Kashmir for a month. And so I came straight into the sick quarters, and we went up to Srinagar in Kashmir. We had our own houseboat up there, and an absolutely marvellous holiday. Went up by lorry and a local bus and lorry, and tapped ponies, and eventually we got out to these at Srinagar, and out to these houseboats. Beautiful houseboats they were, with sumptuously furnished with beautiful silk blankets and cushions and things, and the native wood carvings. There were great people for wood carvings there. It was a really nice holiday. Well, then by the time we got back to Kohat again, the overseas tour had been reduced from 5 years to 4 years. So I thought, that's it, then I'm lucky boy, I'm going to be coming home. This was in August.
August
of 1938. And then we saw a new breed of airmen start to arrive on the unit. These were corporal observer gunners, previous air gunners who'd been given their NCO corporal stripes and a short course as observers, and they're posted out then as corporal observer gunners onto the station. And they had tales of all of the expansion that was going on at home. Of course, we had not known anything about this, of course. The tour was reduced to 4 years. Well, I was expected to warn that I should be going home on this trooping season that was coming up. My tour was over 4 years, you see, and it could be any time between October and April. Now, when would that be? About September. I forget the exact date, but during September there was this trouble with Hitler. He demanded the cession of Sudetenland, and Neville Chamberlain, who was the Prime Minister, went out to Munich. That's it. Well, at that time, 60 Squadron's war base was Singapore, and we were told to get ready to go to Singapore. We packed up, everything was packed up, all our kit was packed up and returned to stores. We had a small kit, and we were all ready, the squadron was ready to move. And in fact, it got to the day when we were warned that we would be moving in the next day. And it was that night, at about 11 o'clock in the night, we were told that something was happening, stand by, don't go to bed. Well, we were there very tense and apprehensive about whether we're going or what's happening, when the news came through that of the Munich Agreement, and so we were stood down.
What was your reaction to that, to the news of the Munich Agreement?
Thankfulness, of course. I was only 3 weeks after that when I, a bit longer than that, but I came home before Christmas anyway, and so of course I was very thankful to go and draw my kit out of stores and return to normal base again. You know what happened the following year, of course it was disaster. The squadron did in fact move, and the ones who didn't crash on the way, some of the aircraft crashed on the way. There were old Wapiti's aeroplanes, you know, that I had, and one or two of them crashed on the way and ran out of fuel and so on. It wasn't a very happy time for 60 Squadron at all. And of course they ran straight into the trouble at Singapore. But in the meantime, I returned to England, and of 700 airmen who'd got on the boat at Karachi, there were 700 corporals who'd got off the boat at Southampton. Every one of us were promoted, and most of us found a way to training schools as instructors.
Where did you go personally?
I was put to a new school at Locking at Weston-super-Mare. I was posted there as an instructor. And in fact, the school hadn't been opened then. It was our first 6 months there was equipping the workshop equipment, toolkits and aeroplanes that were coming in for instructional purposes and so on. That was my first 6 months at Locking.
So you were teaching people to become training. Metal riggers? And
yes, that's right.
And
yes.
Air gunners?
Yes, yes. My first pupils came in about mid-39, and these were sailors, volunteers from the fleet. They were able seamen and stokers, long servicemen who'd volunteered to join the fleet air arm. That was a task because they were heavy-handed, these sailors, and they were smashing up the aeroplanes to start with, you know. They had to learn to be gentle handling stuff. And there were several hundred sailors put through before we started on airmen at Locking.
At what stage did you feel that war was inevitable?
Well, I think that after this realization, when we were packed up to go to Singapore, we were sort of when I returned home, we found such an expansion of airmen. You see, when I'd left England to go out to go abroad in 1934, I could have gone on to any station in the RAF and found someone that I'd known. There were.
Because it was such a small service.
Because it was such a small, the total strength of the Air Force in those days was 30,000. And you could go around, it was like going from home to home. You knew people everywhere and you had a friendly welcome. Well, when the expansion started, there were stations, or when I returned home, people were talking about RAF stations I'd never heard of. And places like this school that I'd gone to was a brand new school. It was built at Locking at Weston-super-Mare. It was just built from nothing, and of course it was happening all over the country. I think the expansion had started in 1936, when some of the must have been planned well before that, but all these modern stations that were all built on the same pattern, they were built before the war and commissioned in 1938. The expansion had missed us abroad. But it had been going on all the time. And of course I also found out that I missed out on promotion as well, because those of us who'd been abroad in these static stations had missed out on the expansion and missed out on some of the promotion that was going on at that time.
What did you feel about the prospect of our Air Force against the Luftwaffe before the war broke out?
I don't think I'd ever given it a thought. We were really that we thought we were the British Empire. We were invincible. We had the greatest fleet in the world. We had the finest air force in the world. I didn't think if we thought of it at all, we didn't think that anyone would be so silly as to tackle the British Empire.
So when war was declared, did it come as a surprise to you?
Well, I think I think it did. I know I can remember the occasion when war was declared. I was doing guard commander on a Sunday morning. I was doing guard commander with a mixed bunch of airmen and sailors, and we had guard duties as part of their training, as well as our own, you know, down there. And it did come as a shock when it really happened, but we never, of course, dreamt that it would be such a war, or even had no idea what sort of war it would be, because it was not a war like any other war had ever been. So we were sort of venturing into, comfortably into the unknown, as far as we were sort of no fear that there would be any question of defeat or anything. The great shock, of course, came with Dunkirk. That's when the real shock came, and we felt we had our backs to the wall. Whereas we at Locking, we turned out of our rooms and we went into tents, and the troops were coming back to Plymouth and were coming by train straight up to Locking directly, and were coming into Locking absolutely exhausted, straight off the boat, straight from the beaches at Dunkirk. That was the time when we really sort of thought there could have been a possibility of defeat, I suppose, as everyone did at that time.